sure most of you know OMDC, but for those who don't, we're an agency of the Ontario government, and our mandate is to stimulate employment and investment in the creative media industries. In today's session, we're diving into the world of augmented and virtual reality content, an industry that is projected to grow a staggering 89% by 2020, when it will be valued at $16 billion globally. I'm pleased now to introduce our moderator this morning, Nigel Newton. Nigel Newton is a consultant for AR innovation and strategy and previously has worked for Layar and Blipper Canada. He's now working with AWE on the world's largest location-based VR experience, which launches at Fort York this summer, on an AR exhibit with Mayhew Digital for next year's Canada 150 sesquicentennial celebrations, and with Indy on their broadcast AR solutions for Toronto Zoo and the Montreal Biodome. Nigel is a frequent commentator and public speaker on immersive content and has presented at Canadian Music Week, Digifest, as well as Interactive Advertising Bureau, IAB, and Screen Industries Research and Training Center, CERT, events. Please join me now in welcoming Nigel and our four panelists, Nyla Inukshuk, Srinivas Krishna, Lucy LaLumiere, and Jaylee Williams. Thank you.
Thanks, Serena. It's very kind of you, and looking forward to having an interesting conversation this morning with the panelists. But before we get started, I was just curious, there's been a lot going on in VR in the city generally, and Raina mentioned Pop 1, which was opened up at TIFF on Friday. I had good fortune to be able to go and see it. I was just wondering, who either went to Pop 1 this weekend, or was at VRTO? So there we go. So VRTO is an industry conference that happened over the last couple of days with both panels, and I think all of you guys were out there at some point this weekend with colleagues in the industry and networking and discussing the finer points of VR. What I'd like to do first is introduce the panel, so that they get a good idea of who's here, and we have a delegate list, and thank you to Raina for arranging that. Just wanted to see how many people in the room currently are involved in an augmented reality production or a virtual reality production. So good proportion here. And how many would like to be? There we go. So we'll get on to that. I mean, what our objective here this morning is to identify the value chain in AR and VR, and we felt as a panelist that one of the most important components about identifying what the value chain is to explain what we regard as the value chain. So from our point of view, it's assessing delivering value in the product, the end product, to the consumer, but that begins at the conceptual stage and runs through every component of that process through pre-production to production to post-production to distribution, in ensuring that every component that we put in place has the qualities that we are looking for to ensure a really valuable experience. And that's where value for us comes into the component. But we felt it was necessary to address what do we categorize as augmented reality and virtual reality, because it's a very wide spectrum. And augmented reality has been with us for many years, and it has a conception in terms of two components. It's either mobile-based through your phone, or it may be an installation at an exhibition or in a public space. And then VR has two components. You either have live action, which can be documentary or it can be scripted, and it's usually 360 and immersive, but it can then also be seen on many platforms. So whether you happen to again use your mobile device or use a desktop browser which is fully enabled like Google Chrome to allow you to move the scene around your point of view. But then it also translates to the viewer in cardboard, to the headset with Samsung Gear, to a tethered headset with Oculus Rift and with HTC Vive, and then to the mixed reality components beyond that of Microsoft HoloLens and Meta. So there's a, as you can see, there's a, what we are involved in has a very wide range in scope. You'll see from the outside, I don't know how many of you were able to take a look at some of the content that was suggested here on the VR viewers. But again, that will be available, should you wish to have a look, after the panel session as well, for probably about half an hour. So now I've set the scene, I'd like to sort of do some introductions to the panel. And I'll start with my extreme left, with Jay Lee. An award-winning visual effects and animation director, Jay Lee is co-founder of 1188 Films, and they marry film, visual effects, animation and design into compelling multi-platform experiences for brands and artists. His latest company, Occupied VR, is a presence company, and I'll let him expound on that later, that's developed immersive experiences for Nike, Intel, Mad Decent, Sony, NBC and Universal Media, David Cronenberg, and Vice. Producing both full CGI and 360 video content, Occupied has recently developed and released its own 360 camera rig. And then next to Jay Lee is Lucy Lalumiere, founder and principal of Lalumiere Media. Lucy is a consultant who specializes in the business of interactive digital media, VR and AR, advising clients on funding, strategy, and business development. The COO and GM of Supersonic Minds, a startup at the nexus of entertainment and brain training. She's also an independent producer working with 360 Story Lab on the I always pause here, Burned episodic 360 video series. I get caught by the VR in Burned. And she's been on the board of directors of Interactive Ontario for over 10 years. Srinivas Krishna applies his 25-year career in film, television, and interactive digital media to his ongoing work in augmented and virtual realities. Founder of Awe Company here in Toronto, he's currently launching, and full disclosure, working with him on this launch, of one of the world's largest VR experiences at the Fort York Historic Site here in Toronto. Through research partnerships with Ryerson and the Ontario Institute of Technology, he's developed interactive 3D experiences for mobile devices, enjoyed through smartphones, tablets, or VR head-mounted displays, where they blend animated virtual characters, architecture, and landscapes with real worlds inside and outside, matching and scaling to the audience's real surroundings. Nalema Nikshuk, next to me, is one of the key operators, and I'm going to murder this pronunciation, of Pinguac. Was that pretty
close,
good?
Pretty close.
Pretty close, okay. A company rooted in the creation of unique cultural experiences that operates in Ontario, Nunavut, and BC. Their collective mandate is to create interactive experiences that push both the limits of technology and cultural expression. Pinguac has created games, films, and environments in virtual spaces and is currently creating immersive marketing extensions of feature films, including the TIFF Best Bang Bang Baby, and on video game and art music collaborations with artists including Philip Glass, The Strumbellas, A Tribe Called Red, and Tanya Tagak. So, those are the guys that are in here to give you their insights on these things. But I'm going to start with Nyla. Nyla, as a producer, you may have the luxury of a commission piece with, say, sufficient budget to cover a VR shoot, and maybe even post-production. But what are the options there to capture content, stitch the experience together, and distribute the finished product?
Yeah, so, I mean, of course, it's great if you have a budget. and so some of that, and, I mean, there's... Full disclosure, there's a client that I'm working with in this audience who's providing some of that budget from a record label. But yeah, it's distribution of VR is really interesting because we're still trying to figure out how to monetize it. The obvious ways to get stuff out there and to have the most eyes on it is through YouTube 360 or Facebook 360, both of those video players. They're not particularly immersive or interactive, And then maybe you can get like a company like Samsung to put it on their platform. But then still people aren't really paying for it outside of like advertisements and stuff like that. So with us, like a great thing is if there's already a room for digital media component in a budget for a pre-existing piece, that's an obvious way to go because say there's a television series, they have to spend based on the new guidelines with CMF. They're not that new anymore, but you know, if you have to spend a certain amount on digital media, it might as well be made instead of just like putting up an interactive website or whatever that you need to qualify for that grant. It'd be great to have like an app or just like a VR experience, something like that. But we've been also creative in terms of distributing and trying to find out ways to show content. One is which we're actually filming a found footage horror film, and we're going to just be releasing the raw files online in the middle of the night on forums like Reddit and then having people stitch them together and have them really be involved in the interactive process. And they feel like they're part of the creators of the work, which is really cool because that's what we're kind of relying on with VR, because you are giving a bit of ownership away to the audience because they get to choose where they look, how they get to experience it, and then they can experience it. They can watch it 100 times and never have the same viewer experience. So we're kind of taking that a step further and just allowing them to actually stitch the video together, and they can do whatever they want with it. So that's just one way that we're, and that is being paid for. Like, I think the CBC is paying us for something else, but we're putting it towards that. They're paying for the making of, and then we're just using that money to pay our actors. So
the collaborative process is kind of in there as well. I mean, one of the things that I think interesting in the room, we saw that there are people who are currently in production and people who would like to get into production. Getting started with the kind of, within your collective, I mean, you do things through small budgets, getting things going, being creative, trying to capture content. Where do you start? If you would, from your experience, what was a good way in to get a flavor for getting to your first production off the gate?
The first production was with a company called Scythia Films. They had a film called Bang Bang Baby that was at TIFF, and I was working on with the producer on a 2D movie, so traditional, flatty. But boring. And so we were working on a separate project, but then they had this film coming out that was and they had a trailer, and it was going to have its theatrical release, and it was a small Canadian indie, and they had their trailer that got 10,000 views, which is great for a little Canadian indie. And then we produced our VR trailer for the film, and in 4 days it got 250,000 views. So it obviously showed that it was a medium that people were engaged in and were excited about, and it raised buzz for the film. So it obviously worked in that sense. So for that, we were building on existing content, so extensions of media that's already out there. So films, or we're doing the same for television series, where it's they've already got their market, and then we're just enhancing that viewer experience. That's how we got in. We also do video games and that sort of thing. So that's a little separate, but. For us, that's kind of how we started.
And Jaylee, when you were sort of in that arena for the Much Music Video Fact with Grand Theft and the piece... Sorry?
Yeah, Grand Theft and Andy. The first one we did was for Andy Kim, actually.
Right. Yeah. So, and those were they also extensions of 2D Flatties?
No, but the when we did Andy Kim, it was actually the first time Much Fact had supported a virtual reality project, so they required a broadcast video as well.
Right.
So, yeah, I guess for that one. But then when we did Grand Theft, they had told us that they had updated their policy, so they actually didn't require a broadcast at that time. So
when you're looking at the kind of the value that you're creating around the VR experience, Nyla was there talking there about the extension she got from the audience where, around a preview just because of the medium, with the process there with creating the pieces for first Andy Kim and then Grand Theft, it became more of about a singularity of an experience in it unto itself. So it wasn't sort of like an extension. Now we have this ability to create this experience.
Yeah, I mean, the Grand Theft one isn't out yet, but the Andy Kim came out when he was inducted to the Canadian Hall of Fame. Actually, that was the day that we did the other panel.
Yeah, that's right.
And that was the same day that we released that. It was about a year later, and it lives on Samsung Milk VR, which is now Samsung VR.
Yeah, I guess Chris Milk made them change the name or something.
Yeah, I don't know. I think the people was getting confused, and then he changed his name. It was getting too confusing, but yeah, so it lives there. There's no real analytics on the Gear VR, which is sort of sucks, so we can't really see what it's doing.
Yeah.
But because sort of, you know, we're making virtual reality, not 360 video, we don't really have it live on YouTube and stuff right now. But I guess we'll put it out there to see what the analytics can give us.
Right. Now, Lucy, when you have that kind of initial production run up, you know, you're sitting with the director, the DOP, the crew, the visual effects person, and you've got this kind of notion and an idea forming in your mind as to what the project's going to look like, then you have to figure out, okay, what is the reality of shooting virtual reality?
Right.
And you have to begin to look at the kind of the approach. Now, would you say that's probably one of the most critical components in that our sector faces right now in getting projects going, is overcoming that inertia?
I wouldn't say it's the most important issue, but it's certainly something we need to think about. Because when you shoot in 360, and we shot our first episode of a narrative movie, you really need to think about how people will engage with the story, because the people are the camera, per se. And in our case, we basically designed it so the camera, the person looking at it, is the proponent in the film. So we have to think about this. We have to think about the flow. And once you get to the shooting, it's also very different. I was talking to the actors playing in our episode. And for them, it was more akin to a theater experience than to a movie or a TV shoot, because once they start shooting the scene, they have to do it from A to Z in a 360 environment. So the writer needs to think about what's going to be the engagement and what will be the triggers as well to attract the attention of the user to certain points, because at one, you know, in the narrative, you need to try to direct the attention of people to certain aspect. You don't want them to be there when something important is happening there. So sound is very important as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sound and some visual trigger, but sound is the most important. It is important. But I would say, from my point of view right now, what's really important is to start experimenting, because so many things are changing quickly. The tools are improving very quickly. We're learning. We shot the first episode. The next five are going to be test beds for different things. And we know it's going to change from one to the other one, and we'll learn. So I really encourage you to start experimenting.
So when you sat down with the director and the producer and you first had this idea, was it for a longer scripted narrative film?
No, we right away we started with the idea of doing a short, because right now in VR, I haven't seen any long form video, and I don't think people would tolerate it for long. I've been over an hour in VR in a game, but for video content, I think it would be difficult. So most content is between 5 to 10 minutes, but we want to do an episodic, because we think that
it has greater opportunities for recoup its costs. I'm not going to say make money out of it, but you know, if the first one really works and engage people and we have a fan base, then we may be able to crowdfund or we may be able to interest some distributor in helping. So the hope is that we'll be able to at least recoup our costs at the end of the process.
And then not just be because you had a desire to get one element in the can for experimentation to then see what the reaction from an audience was and the feedback you got, but also because the realities of shooting in production and then post mean that if you put your own effort and sweat equity into the first production, then you can develop that traction. But I seemed also to that when you were preparing yourselves for the production, you also saw that down the road that there was a lot of content beginning to be ready for the pipeline, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for reminding me. Right now, I have the Samsung every hour at home, and there's a lot of tourism content or music-related content or even documentaries you can find quite a bit. But in terms of narrative content, stories, there aren't that much. So right now, there aren't a lot of people doing this. It's starting, and we saw an opportunity to position 360 Story Lab early in the game in producing narrative content. So, because it's going to change very quickly. Around the world, so many people right now are producing things and are starting to do narrative content. Just if you want to see a good piece of comedy, last week I saw Interrogation from Funny or Die. It's a very well-done 360 narrative. So it's starting, and big brands like Funny or Die are starting to create narratives.
Excellent. Now, Srinivas, you've seen ongoing change in user interfaces since you started into this adventure in 2012. Lucy was mentioning incorporating feedback and iterating and new technology coming on. What has your team done to incorporate feedback as you've gone along to develop your interfaces, but from tablet into headsets?
Right. That's a really good question. When we started so early in the game that there was really no knowledge about anything, so we were pioneers in a sense. The first thing we did was an augmented reality drama in a place called the Blockhouse, which is the oldest surviving building in Toronto at Fort York. And I'll just share an anecdote. It was for 5 users on an iPad, and you know, no one had ever done anything like this. So when we started the user testing, we did it in a classic sense that we didn't give people no information. We just gave them each an iPad and turned on the lights and started the show. And, you know, you start by holding it down at your feet and the camera goes on. And I'd have to say 3 out of 5 people never moved. All they did was they listened to the soundtrack and looked at their feet for 15 minutes. It got better as time went by, you know, and we realized, well, we have to give some kind of clues. It was that afternoon we had, on the other hand, we had kids. The first group was about 45 to 55, and then we had kids in the afternoon, and they got it immediately. I mean, they were looking around and walking around and talking to characters and interacting. Mm-hmm. So, you realize it's a generational thing. You start understanding audiences. That taught us a huge lesson about user testing as we develop at every stage, not just at the end, but at every stage of development. And that's what really taught us about what people respond to, what they understand, what kind of user interfaces and how many prompts, what kind of prompts you need to give, the importance of sound. We understood that very early on. It's not just sound that gets people to focus. It's much like in films or in theater. If everyone, or even on the street, if everyone in the scene is looking in the same direction, chances are you as an audience will too look in that direction. So those are the kind of visual cues that you need to start thinking about when you're staging shows in a 360-degree environment. So that's really, Nigel, how we proceed is we do testing every step of the way with pretty much every element of the show. And we do it first with real people, playing the part of animated characters, and then we do it with storyboards, and we do it right down to the finished production. And when we do it, we start with really no cues every time. It's not like we know or assume that what we learned the last time still applies. Right. We start from ground zero every time, and that way we learn what also recurs from instance to instance and what really stands the test of time. Mm-hmm. Age is the biggest differentiation, frankly, especially with mobile experiences where you're walking around. There are people who are... I've had people say to me, I resent your show. Why can't I just sit down and... This should just be given to me. You know, and so it's just, it is the biggest differentiator, I find.
What's interesting is when Samsung Gear go out and they demo their products in the marketplace, quite often what they will do is they'll seat people in swivel chairs. And then if they don't see them moving their head around, they'll actually come up behind them and move them around, and then people will go, oh! And that's kind of indicative that there are a relatively limited number of VR headsets in the marketplace. Jay Lee, what do you say, with this kind of emerging marketplace, what are the opportunities for entry? You know, where do you see that traction in creating that value for the end user experience? I mean, you were at Cannes recently, and one of the comments that you told me was that there was content there which was great, but you still kind of looked at the thinking, well, why did they need to do that in VR? So what are the specific opportunities and how do they relate them?
You mean opportunities for the general...
For creating people? A valuable experience for the end user. You know, why choose VR, in other words?
I mean, I think that people nowadays want to be immersed, you know. They want their presence to be changed. I think that we're at a point where... we're sort of getting bored a little bit. And, you know, I mean, like, there's, like, these regular games where people go down and they're in a story, a mystery story or something like Clue or whatnot, or they have to find their way out of a maze. I think people want to be somewhere else and they want to experience more. You know, trying out virtual reality is undeniable. Like, you know, once you see a good experience, you just sort of can't forget about it. You know, it's like memories. We're sharing memories, you know, and something like the internet did that sort of like, it made the world seem a bit smaller and all of us a little bit tighter. I think VR is going to do that and open up our minds. You know, every time I travel anywhere in the world, I always feel that I come back changed. And so now, you know, and I've seen some good experiences where it's taken me to places that I've never expected to go or see. And it sort of changes me too, you know? And I think that, I mean, right now we're doing a documentary with Vice that has the Prime Minister in it. Yeah, and we got the shot with him and these on a reserve. And it was quite interesting, but, you know, spending some time with these people. There's a flat documentary and a 360 documentary, which is what I was working on. And when people are, you know, as a user testing, when people are watching the flat component to a certain interview, which is really sad, about a father talking about his daughter who committed suicide, people are getting an emotional pull from that in the flat version. But then when we put them in the 360 version, they're taking the headset off crying, right? And I think that it's like all these like little nuances and things that you can pick up inside of VR when you're sitting across from somebody and not just watching them through a box, that really sort of translate to something that you couldn't get, we weren't getting before. So I think that there's like all these opportunities to explore new ways to show things from around the world and stories and whatnot that are going to help people grow and become closer together and help us understand this world more. And
have you seen a noticeable change recently in the quality of content that's coming through? Like when you were at Cannes, I mean,
yes and no. I mean, there's a lot of content being made, so it's easier to say that we're starting to see some better content. But then places like Cannes, there was some experiences that shouldn't have been there.
I have some friends at Cannes that they were like, well, I made that six months ago, and now it's because it's changed so quickly in 6 months. It's like I probably wouldn't have submitted that piece, but it got into Cannes.
Yeah,
so.
And it's like you can't say no to Cannes, right? Like if they want to show something. I mean, what we showed something that was about 2 years old, but I mean, it still played well. It's right. The Cronenberg experience, the first one we did with the CFC. And then we also showed Technolux, which is a game that we started that we created a mini story from. But but people were taking headsets off because, like, you know, some people had not taken into consideration the horizon line and stabilization and stuff like that, and like what the end user is going to be picking up on. Like, if your horizon line is moving and wiggling all around, it sort of makes people vomit, right? No, it does. Well, it makes people feel sick anyway. I haven't seen actual anyone vomit yet, but to get close. So you know, I mean, it's an interesting time. There's some, like, a lot of new gear coming out rapidly, and the Samsung camera just came out, and it's actually not bad for if someone just wants to start playing around and understanding the space. But the gear is coming out. I mean, even that one, it stitches on your phone, and you know, I mean, like, you can stitch on your phone now, which is awesome. But you know, we rewind a couple years ago, and there was nothing for us to play with. So I think that it's about how people are going to use the content. I think there's going to be a lot of bad content, but I think that's because there's a lot of people trying to understand and play around with you know, what we're working with. Yeah?
So Lucy, when you look at this, I mean, you look at the notion that there's many different values of and levels of experience in the marketplace. I mean, we could, at one extreme, we can see something like, which is coming into Times Square next week, I think it is, for The Void, which is a hyper-reality experience where they add that immersive experience to exterior influences and sensory perception. But when you've got kind of like, you've got that, you've got the mixed reality mashups coming with Microsoft HoloLens and with Meta, like, do you think we're seeing an ecosystem developing? How far are we away from it just kind of like being a natural progression, and all of a sudden we're just going to feel all of this content being around us?
Certainly there's an ecosystem developing. It's not stable, though. You know, it's a nascent industry. So we have various players experimenting from, you know, hardware to software to content. And there's going to be a lot of learning. Plus, the market is still small right now. So it's going to take, in my opinion, about 3 to 5 years to stabilize as an ecosystem. But it's going to be very vibrant. And we've been talking a lot about film. I'm glad you mentioned Technoloss. Games are a different ball game in VR. There are business models for games in VR. People will pay, and I pay for games in VR. And there are, you know, great companies here in Ontario working on VR games. Technoloss, in fact, is one of the
success.
No, but I've heard a lot about it. Apparently, it's one of the top ones.
You haven't played Technoloss?
I mean, we made Technoloss.
Okay. I was going to say, I thought you just said you hadn't played it. I was like, dude.
No. I haven't played it yet.
I played it, I think, at one of its first, like, it was a couple years ago. Right. And I think it's changed since then.
I'm actually a character in it now. I'm the guy that gives you your missions. Yeah, I'm sort of like a Chinese guy that just gives you your missions. It's really weird and creepy, yeah.
But it's one of the most popular...
Yeah, it is. It won a bunch of awards in the last round. Yeah.
Have you made it available for Vive?
Yeah, it's on Vive now.
Oh,
yeah.
Nice.
So yeah, see, there's an ecosystem for game development, and there are companies. I see Matt from Quantum Capture here, who are positioning themselves as leaders in this industry. So, is it going to be stable? No. It reminds me of when the internet started in Canada. It's a lot of buzz. Hype, a lot of people involved, then there may be a bit of a drop in terms of, you know, the hype, but it's there to stay. And the HoloLens you mentioned, I tried it. HoloLens is augmented reality experience. That, in my opinion, is going to change how we interact with content and application, not only in terms of entertainment, but pretty much everything.
Yeah. Srinivas, So I heard about the kind of like the notion that there's many different levels of content experiences around. And much of the content that we've talked about today can be accessed on a mobile device, but then there are the other extreme of the spectrum where you have to be tethered to a computer and you can't really walk around and experience things. So that kind of the contrast between a mobile experience and a passive kind of tethered experience. What is the key to differentiator here? And for you, what does that mean about value for the audience experience?
That's another great question. We, from the beginning when we started, were committed to the untethered experience. We started on iPads, and now we're on smartphones, and we use, you know, Google Cardboard and Gear VR. We're not really that interested in the passive experience. To me, I've never been a gamer. Pac-Man, you know. But after that, you know, the thought of sitting down for hours and it's like just not mine game. So what really excited me and what drew me into this space was the idea that with mobile devices, I saw an opportunity for being able to inhabit the game world and have different kinds of experiences from that and being mobile. So what's really amazing about this industry is how it's really gone into a passive experience mode of sitting down and having this. And it's because, I guess, of immersion and the kind of immersion you get when you sit and you're enveloped. But really, you can't walk around with those things strapped to your head. Believe me, I know we tried because we user test everything, right? So, you know, you fall down. That said, and, you know, we tried that at Fort York. You have these, you know, in 360-degree recreations of historical events that you're immersed in as you walk around the site. That's essentially the experience. And in fact, you can walk around inside those experiences, but we tell people not to do it because they do fall down. The difference in the quality of experience is when you're mobile and you have a mobile device, it's the thing that we're so... it changed my life, the mobile device. And when cameras and, you know, these screens came to it, fundamentally, for those of us who are old enough, it just changed everything. The idea that you can walk around and you become yourself a kind of broadcaster of content. You're not just a consumer. And that's what mobile and all the, you know, software capabilities that came with it did for us. And so when we look at, you know, tethered versus untethered, what we look at is really the opportunity to have content on the go, out of home, and to create it yourself and share it, and to attach that to location. So as you're mobile in the world, you have content experiences of all kinds that are fundamentally user-generated. And I think that's what we're going to start seeing over the next 5 years, that as inevitable as YouTube was inevitable. And I think that's where the value is really going to lie for the average user. And I think it's still in mobile devices. I don't think it's in those high-end, you know, headsets. I think the cost of those are prohibitive. I own them, you know, and as a company, we own them. We find them prohibitive to develop on. And just when we look at the numbers of people who are going to have those devices, and we keep wondering, why should we build for these guys? Because who actually owns these? You know, if you want to make money at this game, you really have to be in that mobile space.
Yeah. So, except for the PlayStation.
Yeah, exactly.
Except for the PlayStation, yeah, absolutely.
When it comes, like, you know, maybe bundled with a console like PlayStation, or the, and this is like more restrictive, the HoloLens with Microsoft and the Xbox, but like the PlayStation, my parents have a PlayStation. Yeah. They don't play video games. They get it because it came bundled with Netflix. So
they bought a PlayStation so they could watch Netflix.
Yes.
So all of these kind of content packages. Well, anybody who wants to understand that later can ask Nyla after the end of the panel. As we kind of like look at the all of the common components, you mentioned, Nyla, one of the things about the production of things is audio. Now, audio applies whether you're in 360 content, full CGI, if you're in a game.
Yeah.
Spatial audio is a science unto itself.
Yeah.
But how easy is it to make sure that you take care of that component in the production process?
A lot of the time it gets forgotten, the audio portion of VR, but I would argue that it's more important than the visuals. There are some great experiences. You can watch something that was made, I think it was like 6 years ago. It's called The Haircut. You can watch it on YouTube. Just with some, and it's just, there's no video, it's just audio, but it's omnidirectional microphones, and you can feel someone's walking around you in this experience, and you can hear them, and it actually feels as if they're there. They start snipping at your hair, they put a bag over top of your head. It's like, it's really, really immersive. It is an experience, and it's based completely on audio. And so, that's something. And we just for fun, I'm working with friends to build cameras, but also 360 omnidirectional microphones. because that's something you do in your spare time. And it's really exciting. And it's the audio experience is absolutely essential. And we're working on a few different audio projects that incorporate sound and how that changes depending on where you're looking. And the user actually gets to create their sound environment based on where they're turning their head and looking in a VR world.
Jaylee, I mean, you go into environments around the world with your GoPro rig or your custom rig that you've developed.
Yeah.
What kind of microphone do you port along with you?
Like Tetrasonic mic or omnidirectional. You know, as long as we're collecting the information. And then a lot of time we also just collect audio, so like boom mics and stuff, and we bring them in and we spatialize them in like a game engine, or our audio guys have some new programs that spatialize audio. So you can actually just take the way you pull in traditional audio as well and spatialize it in post, which is quite interesting, a good effect.
Yeah. Excellent. Now we're going to go to Q&A. Earlier on, Raina mentioned that we have the volunteers with the microphones. So if, they're at the back here. So either side of the audience here, do we have a question? So we have a question down here on the right, and then one at the back behind you.
Hi there. Thanks for what you guys were saying. Heard some really interesting things. I'm curious, there's a lot of talk about VR, and I'm wondering if it's a technology thing, if it's a, you know, a user-based knowledge thing. There's a lot more talk in, right now in VR than AR, and seeing AR, and from a personal experience, I actually enjoy AR experiences better because I feel like you can do them in a community and see those things, see the other people and things like that. I'm wondering what your takes on that is it just AR is, you know,
yeah.
Well, technically it's older, but it's just not right. As developed yet, or?
Srinivas, do you want to just, because you started out in AR, right, doing your first experiences?
I frankly see very little difference between the two and never have, except for the idea that with augmented reality, it's really, you're much more mobile than you are with virtual reality, for the simple fact that when you're immersed, you really should not be walking around, as I said. But other than that, there really are, I don't think we're going to see much of a difference going forward as we see more and more mixed reality or blended reality experiences of the kind that we really do specialize in.
Yeah. I mean, I think from my perspective, having worked in mobile AR, there are components that VR really excels at, and then there are components that AR really excels at. And if you need to provide something immediately in context, then AR is the best vehicle for it, because you retain what you see in the real world and you put a layer of content over the top. If your intent is to focus the audience's attention to a specific experience, then VR is essential, because you are taking out and shutting out the real world to immerse yourself in another one. But if you don't do either one better than you could do in a flat 2D experience, then you've lost the opportunity. So it's really more about the quality of the experience and what you want to see as an outcome from the end user.
I would add, the reason why we're talking a lot about VR is there are no consumer headsets available right now for AR in the market, so it's coming.
But you don't need a headset for AR. You can just use a mobile phone,
true,
right?
True, but you know, most, you know, if
in
AR...
In fact, you don't need a headset. In fact, true, you'd rather not have a headset.
They're developing, like, contact lenses, yeah, so that you can just, like...
Yeah, but that's quite a bit of ways away, I would say.
And then, Jaylee, you posted on Occupied's Facebook page the picture of the Magic Leap thing. I noticed, I mean, maybe it wasn't you,
it wasn't me.
Harold or somebody.
Yeah, I don't do the social.
But Magic Leap is yet to come to market to reveal what it looks like. But to your point, Nyla, about the contact lens, is that the idea is that they will present a image to your ocular reference naturally, so that you see something across from the real world. These technologies are coming. I mean, as Srinivas said, the device that you choose to interface with the content really is about the experience that you generate. We have that question at the back.
So I was actually just wondering how it works with basically iteration. So essentially, do you, for VR specifically, when you are kind of shooting it, how much R&D and testing do you do before you do the full-blown shoot, and how does the iteration process work thereafter?
Go ahead, Nyla.
Yeah, so it kind of depends. A lot for a lot of people, and I'm sure we've all shot on GoPro rigs in the past where you can get a 3D printed rig and use GoPro cameras that are kind of built to that, and you do some testing on your own. I'm working with friends to build like a red camera rig for a commercial. So that's like, that takes a lot of testing because we're working with like bigger cameras and we're having to literally weld them together and figure that out. But then we've tried for that same project, we tried out, there's a camera called the Ozo, which was...
it's Nokia's and Disney endorsed it, but it's going to get better. They have a patch. One of the challenges was it was shooting at 30 frames a second instead of 60, right? I think one of the interesting things, I mean, Jaylee, you developed your own camera because you weren't satisfied with what you were getting with those 3D printed GoPro rigs, right? I mean, iteration is part of technology, but it's also part creative, right? You're trying to iterate based on what you can achieve.
Yeah, I mean, because I come from a film background, none of the cameras, I built the right camera. I can really actually help you with that. We built a five Red Dragon, and that was a complete nightmare to actually work with. It's worse than the GoPros.
Yeah. We're doing three, shooting 180 and then swiveling around, it's shooting the other 180. Yeah.
But we've been playing around with different cameras and trying to figure out which ones work the best. Things like nodal point too, like where your head's turning. If your cameras are too big and the lenses are out here, then that nodal point is huge, which creates a different type of look. If your nodal point is, you know, right on one, like actually some of the camera rigs we have actually are just one camera, and we just swivel them on a nodal point and then focus them at the direction that we want to shoot in. So slicing up like shooting for virtual reality is like you have four quadrants to work in, which is basically like here, 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 you know, behind you. And so you can actually stage things out and utilize a camera. You can only need, you can do it with one camera, you know, and if you do it right. So, I'd say test a lot, but understand the math that you're working with. That's the big point, right? Because the cameras are going to change, everything's going to change, but the math's not going to change.
Yeah.
You know?
And also understand that, you know, you could be doing this research and developing the greatest thing this week, but next week there's going to be like something else. Someone's going to come, like my 11-year-old, maybe I shouldn't be saying this, my 11-year-old neighbor, he's my stitcher. He's the best stitcher I know. He stitches the video together. And I told him about this self-stitching camera, and he's like, oh, so I'm out of a job. But he's
cast
11.
Aside at
11.
There's no camera that stitches itself that looks good yet.
Right.
There's no camera that's perfect, like does perfect stitching. In the end, we do all hand stitching if you want to get it right.
Yeah. I mean, about the only thing that we have a question down in the front here for the microphone. I mean, one of the only things that you can pick up and experiment and run with right now is a Ricoh Theta, which does a pretty good job, right?
Well, the Samsung is pretty good.
Yeah. I haven't seen the Samsung
it's
yet.
It's better quality than the Ricoh Theta, for sure.
Okay. Yeah. We have a question.
Well, speaking of automatic stitching, are there any comments from the panel on real-time VR? Any kind of experiences that you've seen or recommend?
You mean like stitch to stream?
Well, in terms of content or technology, because that's a really good question. So
streaming. Content, just experiencing real content, what's going on out there. I've heard that CBC is doing something at the Olympics, but
yeah.
Sports is picking up on that big time. I mean, we've been playing around with Stitch to Stream. It's quite interesting, all the ins and outs around it and how it works, but... I mean, generally, you'll see a lot of the time the cameras on the Stitch to Stream are quite from a distance from anything, so that you don't see the parallax issues in the four areas. But I mean, now like you're seeing cameras that are just two like lenses back to back, and they're shooting each way, so you only actually have one stitch line or two, I guess, technically, but one that kind of wraps around. So it's sort of that's the whole point, you know, the whole trick about it is just streaming it without with minimal parallax, right? I mean, there's been some cool events. There are all a lot of sports. We were up for doing tennis. I wanted to see people just keep going left and right. Just watching tennis, you know, in VR would be awesome. But it's going to get a lot better, and it's not going away. I mean, people are going to be attending events nonstop, you know, concerts and things like that. Yeah.
And the CBC stuff you're talking about is Next VR from the U.S., and they have the contract with the Olympic Committee. So the CBC will be getting a feed from that, but we've not learned yet what that is going to look like here in Canada. So how do you access it? Is it through the normal portals? Is it through HTC Vive? Is it through Samsung Gear? Is it just a generic form in Google Cardboard? We had a question at the back there.
Is there a difference between in adoption by consumers for 360 relative to 3D VR? So, you know, two-channel parallax 3D versus just straight flat 360 experiences.
I mean, stereoscopic?
Yeah, stereoscopic versus...
Sorry, what was the question about?
Is there a difference in adoption? I mean, do people prefer one over the other, or is there...
I mean, I think the stereoscopic stuff now is getting better, and when it's done right, it's really, really good. You know what I mean? Especially for, you know, film. Like, you can do it through your game engine, like if you're making a game and you want to spit out a video or something. It does it pretty perfectly, which is awesome. But yeah, if I think that people generally like stereoscopic better if it's done right. But if it's not done right, it can really like strain the viewer. If you're gonna get involved in that, then just really make sure that you have, you know, some people, you know, you really test it and you really sort of work it and spend a lot of time sort of cleaning it up.
And I think in terms of adoption, who's going to be watching and caring about that thing? It's kind of probably going to be between gamers and like hardcore gamers. Difference.
I mean, there's also too with stereoscopic. There's a lot of tools now that actually you don't have to shoot stereoscopic. You actually can do a stereoscopic conversion from monoscopic, which is actually a better. If it's done right, the result is better than shooting stereo. I think. Yeah, it's really clean.
And then from a CGI perspective, that's, I mean, coming out that route, right? I mean, you're developing in one environment, and then you're exporting the content at the end.
Yeah, we only shoot monoscopic. I won't shoot stereo again, I don't think. No. Well, I started off shooting stereo 360. It was just a nightmare. Yeah.
So, I mean, I think one of the terms of adoption as well, what we're looking at here is we don't have many reference points for high volume consumption. There's a piece by Ian Toisson, I think I've murdered his pronunciation of his name
Toisson,
called 3AM, and he had 6 million views on this one short, which is on YouTube, but you really can't determine from an exterior point of view. He may have analytics to say which platform was engaged, because you have the option within the YouTube environment to view desktop, you can view mobile, or you can view in a headset. So where did those 6 million views come from? Was it just primarily 6 million people just on their desktop or on a laptop and just viewing it? Or was it 6 million people who actually had the opportunity to have more immersive experience? We actually don't know yet. We have a question. Murray has the mic.
Thanks, Nigel. I was at the VRTO event over the weekend, and there was some discussion about sort of social responsibility of creators, because the technology is so immersive and can affect people in various ways. Srinivas, you said people fall over if they do it wrong. Jay Lee, I mean, you're putting people into amazing things. So are there any concerns by creators, or is there any work in that area?
Srinivas?
They said the same thing about movies when they were first being made 100 years ago. And there's people who say the same thing about TV and every other medium that comes around. They're the people who come up with the social responsibility handle. I don't know.
Nyla, go ahead.
Yeah, I feel pretty passionately about this, that, and maybe it's just like my biased perspective as an Indigenous woman. I think with VR, there's particular
there's a little added social responsibility in terms of the actual content creators, because we're providing people with a different perspective. We're allowing someone to view the world in a different way than maybe that you have experienced it in the past. So for me, I think it's important to have diversity in when it comes to content creators, because, like, I mean, there's going to be a lot of white men that sounds so stupid, yeah. But like I've had my story told by other people so many times, and so it's like I think there's importance there for having a different perspective, especially when with VR you're giving people a different perspective.
So we're going to wrap it up at this stage. I just wanted to say thank you to the OMDC for allowing us the venue and opportunity today. And I understand that there may be people in the audience who still have questions who would like to address them. So if you, we will be here once we finish, so please feel free. As I mentioned earlier, we're going to have the demos at the back of the room outside available. There is also going to be a resource sheet available, which will give some links and case studies to some Canadian productions that have been done so far, both in virtual reality and in augmented reality. But before we go, one of the things that I've begun to do at these events is just to get you as the audience to introduce yourselves to each other. You all have a shared interest here today. You came here to look and find out information about augmented reality and virtual reality. So beginning with the front row, I'd like you to turn around and introduce yourself to the people behind. So Nikki, introduce yourself to the people behind you, and then the other row, and then do the same thing.
I want to give a plug for the Toronto Time Warp. I go, but I guess it's too late.
I think it might be. Yeah, I'm sorry, I missed that opportunity. Sorry.
Next time.
Yes. Did you have it? Did you put it at the back of the demo?
I don't know. Yes. No, they haven't yet.